Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah, and this is episode number 64, and we're going to talk about Ron Howard's Apollo 13.
One of my favorite movies
of all time.
And rightfully so. Us too.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I'm glad. Yeah, it was, I watched it in the full glory of Blu-ray.
Oh. Did you get burned by the engines when the Apollo 13 took off?
It was good. What a good movie.
Makes me think that, of course, I haven't watched that many of Ron Howard's other shorter movies.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes me think that his true métier, if that's how you say it, is these big ensemble casts telling a big story.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was done in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
So, a while back. A while back now.
But also talking about a while back from 1970.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When the space race was not a race and starting to wind down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much 25 years earlier.
Yeah.
Yep.
And, so much so that I was watching it and when I figured out it was 1970, I said, I don't think I even remember this happening.
Hmm. Well, I know I don't.
Yeah. Well,
I was two. I turned two during this mission.
Oh, well, you have an excuse then. I guess I would have been 13.
Uh-huh.
And my family didn't watch the news a lot. Mm-hmm. I can remember the TV would always be on when, dinner's getting ready and stuff. And I remember F Troop. I remember Lost in Space. But
do you remember Apollo 11?
Oh, yeah. I remember my mom called us in. It was because they show him watching it. It looked like it was night. And I said, it wasn't night. It was like a Saturday morning. My mom called us in and we all sat and watched.
Mm-hmm.
Because she said, this is historic. You want to remember this. And we all went, oh, all right. And I do still remember it. It was impressive. I didn't react like Walter Cronkite because I wasn't old enough to have that perspective. But I can remember the news would be running and it would have the Vietnam War totals and stuff. But none of us paid attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
My family, I know my parents must have paid attention and talked about stuff like that, but really our family didn't.
Yeah.
So this Apollo 13 thing, I guess, didn't hit our consciousness in such a way that the family became aware. And if they talked about it at school, I don't remember.
Yeah, I was always an enthusiast for as long as I can remember. Unfortunately, the Apollo days were over long before I started paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Big time, unfortunately. I lament this all the time. But during high school and things, I always followed the space shuttle. I have Young and Crippen's autograph, who were the first two to fly the space shuttle.
How did you do that?
My dad actually did it.
I don't think he met them.
I think he wrote them and they signed it.
Oh.
Yeah. NASA used to be really, really generous. I remember as a young kid, I would write NASA a letter and they would send me stuff. Photographs. I still have all of it. I kept everything, 8x10 glossy photos of like the moon and, all kinds of things. They had a whole office, promoting the space program.
And for obvious reasons, I guess.
Yeah.
Because look at the sad shadow that they are now.
Yeah.
Well, because one of the first notes I wrote down was, everybody was talking in this movie about beating the Russians.
Mm.
We beat the Russians to the moon because it starts with a party about Neil Armstrong's going to walk on the moon. And for some reason, I'd completely forgotten that as the motivation for the space program, because Now it's turned into, you know, oh, well, we can explore some as long as nobody gets hurt. And yeah, it's easy for me to sound glib. I'm not risking my life or my family, but the people who are interested in doing this don't mind that, as we could see from the movie, which I think is a true representation of the explorer.
Yeah, I think so,
and,
too.
And, you know, they don't want to, but they're willing to take the risk. And it made me just think about, you know, that idea of beating the Russians seems like a very old idea, but didn't it help bring out some of the best in us?
Yeah, I mean, it did.
The goal that we had.
Yeah, it's really amazing when you think about it. I mean, JFK said, I think it was 1961, where he said, hey, let's go to the moon, you know, not because it's easy, but because it's hard.
And because then, no Russians are going to beat us, damn right. It. Let's just say that right now.
And then, what was it, 1969, we're walking on the moon.
Yeah.
Which is just stunning. I mean, it's absolutely incredible to even, you know, today, there's just so much that would have to happen. You know, we can't go to the moon in 8 years today. It's impossible. If we started right now, I just can't believe that, you know, all that technology and the will, it just doesn't seem to be there. And there was a lot of argument back then about safety and things. In the movie, they showed Apollo 1, which was not in space, not in flight whatsoever. It was just a training thing. And there was a fire and 3 astronauts died in the fire. Mm-hmm. And that was Apollo 1. And for them to, I think it was something like 18 or 24 months after that is when Apollo 11 was. So,
wow.
I mean, it's astounding to think about that. You know, if something like that happened today, I mean, they shut everything down, and, you know, I'm all for safety, you know, as much as you can, but things just seem to have gone so far.
Well, and that was a great tragedy, and no one's saying that should happen, but you can't take any great endeavor without there being risk and danger a lot of the time. And yeah, I mean, what's happened to us as a nation? We've turned into a bunch of wusses. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's
out there.
And the litigiousness. Everybody just jumping all over everybody else for mistakes and, you know, can't wait to sue whatever company you think might have money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of that is just shutting things down. You know, it is impressive, the robotic stuff we have going on. We are kind of in a golden age of solar system exploration. I mean, we've got spacecraft around, you know, not every planet, but, I mean, they're all over the solar system. We've got things going on.
Well, and that is neat.
Yeah, it is.
You know, the Mars rovers and all those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd like to think that would be the preparation for sending people, if possible.
Yeah, because there's nothing like sending people, right?
Right, that people can do things that machines can't. And I think that gets forgotten sometimes. Just, you know, you can never predict how it is or what you think of or why it is that people make a difference, but they do.
Yeah, and there's something, you know, the Mars rovers are inspiring. When you see these photographs, they're unbelievable. You're thinking, oh my gosh, this is Mars. I'm looking at a photograph of Mars, you know.
I know.
And sometimes when they, I remember a photo that I saw from the surface of Mars of the Earth. You know, so the Earth is a bright light in the sky of Mars. And they took a picture of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those pictures just blow me away. But there's just something about having a person step out onto the surface of Mars that is life-changing.
Well,
you think it would be history-changing, you know? There was a line in this movie where Tom Hanks says, you know, after watching Apollo 11, he says, we now live in a world in which man has walked on the moon.
Yeah.
And there, you know, that's definitely a before and after moment.
It's that dividing line.
Right, right.
Well, and it's the power of symbolism in the human mind and in the human psyche, which is what Catholics live with all the time.
Sure.
I think that's why we get accused of our religion being so complicated or arcane or whatever, because there is a lot of symbolism. But what that means is you can latch on to all kinds of things that help you spiritually. And a lot of times, actually, I mean, you know, the symbolism of Christ feeding the crowds and then saying, you know, to take care of the poor, or because every poor person, rich or poor, we meet is Christ, or should be to us.
Mm-hmm.
That's a powerful symbol that drives a lot of really good works.
Yeah, certainly, certainly.
So that you can't, we're made to be symbolic people.
Yeah.
That's like Hogfather, remember when we read it? And they said, what will happen? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, the sun won't come up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what would have happened? Well, a ball of gas would have risen over the horizon, and, you know, it's a different thing.
Right, right. Yeah, that's something else. Yeah, what a good book that was, too, Hogfather.
Good.
I love it. I love it.
But, yeah, so I guess the thing I liked about this movie is the whole thing is about the Apollo 13 mission that was supposed to go and walk on the moon, and something goes wrong on the ship. Part of it blows away, and the entire rest of the movie and the true experience was them trying to stay alive and the whole NASA crew on the ground trying to figure out how to solve every problem that came up, because every problem came up that could possibly come up.
That's right.
And
and the heroes of the movie could be, you know, all these engineers and
yeah,
you know, all these people on the ground trying to figure out how to make it happen. And my favorite character was Gene Kranz.
Yes.
I say character, you know, he's a real person.
Yes.
played by Ed Harris.
Yeah.
Real example of leadership and determination and optimism.
Yes.
Yeah, there was a line in which, you know, President Nixon had asked for some information, and they said, well, what are the odds of these guys coming back? And he's like, they're coming back. They're coming back. This is going to be NASA's greatest hour.
They're talking about, so many things could go wrong when they're landing and they're waiting to hear back to see if they made it.
Yeah.
He says, with all due respect, gentlemen, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
Yeah, and that was just fantastic. And the power of that, I mean, just the power of that attitude, you know, that's things that I see in daily life. You know, when you've got a pessimistic attitude and you're working with people with that pessimism, you're like, just go away.
Yeah.
You know, this is going to work. You know, we're going to do what we need to do to make this work. You know, I've been in those situations, and the pessimism is just not helpful.
And a lot of times the pessimism seems to focus on either tiny details that could go wrong or a big picture of imagined problems. I mean, it's kind of one extreme to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And the optimists, not always, they have to have the big picture too, but they just seem to be going, this is our goal, we're going to do it. And they just don't stop and think about that stuff other than another hurdle to get over.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not like he was ignoring facts. In fact, he was very much, listen, let's deal with reality here. I mean, nobody make any guesses. Tell me what you know for sure. And that's another really good piece of advice.
Well, and also the thing about the whole idea of when the carbon scrubbers are going wrong, and he's like, well, take the ones from the module and put them in here, or the command module. And they're like, those are square, these are round. He's like, tell me this isn't a government project.
Oh, yeah.
And Tom and I are looking at each other going, what were they thinking? Probably because it was jobbed out differently.
Two different companies or two different groups of people doing the same thing.
Right.
In two different spacecraft. And yeah, we run into that too, you know, in things that I've designed or been a part of where you're like, why is this one that and that one this? Why can't they both be the same, you know, to save cost and everything? And, you know, until you can step back and look at the whole thing as a whole, you don't even see that kind of stuff. It's all, you know, just people in their own bubble doing their thing.
I think that has to be one of the greatest moments of the movie, talking about man's ingenuity and problem solving. Because for one thing, Every time they're doing math, they've got pencil and paper. Everybody. I mean, yes, they had the computers, but, you know, they're like, check my math. And there's four guys in a row all doing the math, sitting there. No calculators. It was 1970.
Yeah. My dad and I once had a really interesting conversation where he was talking about, you know, I wonder, as these computers get more prevalent and we use computers to design bridges and computers to make or to design buildings, and at what point do we reach where we have very, very, very few people who actually know how to do those things?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so everybody's using computer programs to do these things, but have we lost the knowledge, you know, the basic knowledge to do these things? And at some point in history, will there be nobody that knows how? It's just an interesting thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's how you fall into barbarism,
mm-hmm.
I think. Well, yeah. And I see that actually in something as simple as cooking. I enjoy cooking, but even in my day, you know, there was a lot of people were starting to rely more and more on frozen food, which was coming along in quality and, you know, takeout and all that kind of thing. And now I still remember talking to a young friend of mine. We were waiting for the CSA farmer to deliver whatever. And she's talking about she'd never cooked green beans, fresh green beans before. And she's in her, I guess she's in her mid to late 30s, but her mother didn't cook. Her mother was having to cook, work a couple jobs because the father had left them and all this kind of thing. And so this girl had never been taught how to cook. And she was saying, you know, it's okay when I boil them, but when I, why can't I just cook them in a pan with some butter? That just, I burned them. And I was like, oh, all right, this is more science than you want to know, but I've read more here. Let me talk about the structure of a bean versus a piece of lettuce. But that's, and that's, I don't have to know that much. I just have to have cooked a long time to go, here's how you cook beans. You have to add moisture somehow. They're too much like a tree. Mm. You have stiff cellulose type cells. You have to break it down some. And yeah, so, and so I've been talking to her about, you know, this and that and how you make this soup or how you do that thing. And she's so grateful because no one knows. And I'm thinking, I know a lot of people who don't know the first thing about how to cook. It's like I'm a wizard. And I served something and it was supposed to be some stir fry with these things. And as I was going along, I was like, oops, don't have that. Whoops, my broccoli went bad. Oh, I have zucchini. Oh, whoops. It wound up being a completely different thing. But as Tom said, I've done it for 10,000 hours. So I'm able to just kind of go, I think I can make it work close enough for a dinner. And it was fine. And that's what you're talking about on a higher level. It's the engineering part.
Yeah, yeah, it's just a curious thought, you know, where we're all headed.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a smaller and smaller number of people that that actually know how to do things, and everyone else just kind of running through recipes or or programs. You know what I mean?
Yeah, picking up, you know, frozen lasagna for dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of knowing how to do any of it.
Right, right.
They like to watch shows on cooking. Probably not engineering, but, you know.
Yeah, watch shows.
Truck driving or whatever.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of those foodie shows. They're kind of remarkable. chefs are like, here, you have this, and now make something.
Well, they're it's kind of like the thing of dumping the box out and going, here's what you have.
Yeah, exactly.
To make one filter, to make this fit into this,
yeah,
and
that's
they're pulling
funny.
Off a
yep,
sock.
And using only this. You can only use what you've got in there. Yeah.
Well, the other thing I love is that they didn't stand there and complain about it. They all just grabbed something and started sorting it out to see what they had.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a challenge. And that was neat. You know, once, you know, I think that the leadership was really important, you know, Gene mm-hmm. Kranz's calm and, mm-hmm. You know, which apparently, you know, was portrayed accurately. You know, I've read, Failure is Not an Option by Gene Kranz.
Okay.
I think with that, then you can, you know, start asking these things of people and, man, they really came through. You know, like, hey, we've got enough air to reach here. I remember that when Gene Kranz is on the board. And he said, that's clearly not acceptable. we need to reach here. Go figure out how to do that, you know.
And then the guy going, well, and he was counting on his team to be the best people there were. And they were, because that's when the guy stood up and said, that doesn't even matter. And they all look at him and he's like, they won't have power to even make it there. They've got to turn everything off.
Yeah, and that guy saved their lives right there.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I have to say, Ron Howard did such a great job of, we already knew the basic problems and we knew what the end. And he took that and turned it into a compelling story that every time I watch it, I'm not in as much suspense at the end as before. But when everybody erupts into cheers, I feel it with them. You know, he did a wonderful job of storytelling. It's like the, tell me this one again.
Yeah, he really did, because, you know, all of the information that he was able to portray, it's a really good example. I mean, even in science fiction or anything, you know, when you're trying to convey information that could be pretty darn dry, he manages to do all of it. I mean, I can't think of a moment in the movie where I thought, oh, you know, well, this had to exist because of that, and that's the only reason. It's like, you know, everything has two reasons to exist type of a thing. And it really did a terrific job. I mean, the whole thing, you know, all of the information that he was able to convey. Like Tom Hanks explaining to his kid how the whole mission worked.
Yeah.
And that was a really nice moment. And then at the same time, that scene, the kid was worried about his dad and asking him about the door from Apollo 1. You know, so the scene kind of served two purposes. But in you know, in that relationship, father to son relationship, he was able to explain the whole mission using these models. And, you know, it's just a terrific way to get that done.
Well, and in seeing the wife overhear it, you saw her pride in her husband, her joy in their relationship, and her fear for him.
Yeah, yeah.
In her reactions and just all that. It was beautiful. Well, and then it's got that resonant thread that goes through when later she's having to tell the little boy, well, they had to turn around. He can't bring you a moon rock.
Yeah.
And he says, and he just stops and looks at her and, was it the door?
Was it that door, yeah.
And you just, your heart breaks because he, on his small level, grasps what could happen.
Right, right. I listened to some of the commentary this time around from Ron Howard on there. I didn't listen to the whole thing, maybe the first third of the movie. And one of the things that I really thought was neat was how he tried to be accurate by putting the actors with these people. You know, Jim Lovell, who Tom Hanks plays, you know, is alive and well, and I think he's 85 now. And but, you know, for days, you know, he was able to go and hang out with, you know, Jim Lovell and just talk to him. And the same with Lovell's wife. What's the actress's name again?
Kathleen Quinlan.
Yeah, Kathleen Quinlan. Yeah, she spent time with her, too.
Oh, that's great.
And then some of the little details, you know, that they put in that weren't actual were like that Apollo 11 party. He said that didn't actually happen. He was actually at Mission Control during that. But then, you know, it's interesting on the storytelling. And he was talking about Marilyn Lovell's. She was superstitious about the whole 13 thing. You know, all that was really accurate, and she's embarrassed about it, even now.
Yeah.
And that all that stuff happened, you know. But I just think that that's really excellent. You know, Ron Howard could have ignored all that stuff and just, you know, made his own movie. And but he really made a huge effort, you know, a lot of effort to make this accurate to the people.
And what he did, though, was it's that touch that makes the difference is the human elements. For instance, this time around, for some reason, I paid much more attention to Jim Lovell's mother. Who actually was Ron Howard's mother. I'm pretty sure. Well, and his family was everywhere. The minister sitting on the couch, I believe that was his father.
Oh, how about that?
Rance Howard,
mm-hmm.
and the young guy who takes over talking to the Apollo 13 crew, who's got the red hair. I believe his last name was Howard.
Uh-huh.
And he kind of looked like Ron Howard some. And of course, that one brother that's in everything who's looking.
Clint Howard, right.
He had more of a part than usual, mm-hmm. actually.
Yep.
But so his family was everywhere in that. But I looked at the mother and, you know, she's like, my Jimmy's supposed to be on TV. He's going to walk on the moon. And when they didn't have the show on, and she's mad at the TV guide. But she's the one who, she's worried about him, but she has ultimate faith in her son's ability to get out of anything that can be gotten out of. If they could make a washing machine fly, my Jimmy could fly it.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah, that was so well done, too.
And Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, oh, you want to help? Could you distract his mother? And I just love the valiant... Oh, so did he make Eagle Scout?
And she's, you can tell she's annoyed. I want to watch this. You
know? Yes, of course he did. He's going to land.
That's too funny. That's too funny. That's too funny. But the space program is really interesting from a Catholic standpoint, too, or just a religious standpoint. For example, you know, when you go into space, you know, there are some religions like Islam, for example, you know, they pray towards Mecca and things. What are they going to do in the future when, we go to Mars, you know, when there are Muslims on Mars and they're supposed to pray to Mecca? I wonder how that's going to work. You know, these are things that they've had to think about, you know, even in orbit and things like, I think the Jewish religion has to do with sunrises and, you know, there's some things there. And what if you go through a sunrise every half hour, you know, when you're in orbit? It's like, okay, well, when does the Sabbath begin and when does it stop if the sun is rising every, you know, so many minutes? Interesting stuff.
And we're not animists, so we're not linked to having to be near, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Live things or trees or... I mean, I realize that's being extremely simplistic, but I'm just kind of thinking about those implications. That's one thing I was always grateful for. You know, people who, I want to go to the Holy Land where Jesus was. And that's fine. Mm. I don't really care about that myself, but that's fine if they do. But I was always so grateful that Jesus went, no, I have to go because you're going to get another helper. And so we have the Holy Spirit wherever we go.
Sure, yeah.
We don't worry about the time and space thing so much because we know God is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, and Apollo 8, which was also a Jim Lovell mission, what it did is it just went around the moon, you know, as they're preparing to land, you know, they would send these, okay, this time we're going to go around the moon and back, you know, just learning how to do this. So Apollo 8 was Jim Lovell's, and that was the one where one of the crew members read from Genesis, basically broadcasting to the world. He's reading from Genesis as they're going around the moon, and a bunch of atheists actually filed lawsuits saying, you know, this is separation of church and state and everything, you know, so
they're not allowed anything personal. Yeah,
it was a headache that NASA didn't need. But Buzz Aldrin, who was not Catholic, he's a Presbyterian, I think.
Okay.
He actually took communion on the moon before they got out.
That's
Yeah, and I have a little piece of his book. He has a book called Magnificent Desolation.
Hmm.
And he talks about, you know, he was going to do it publicly, but he was advised not to because of the Apollo 8 thing and all the lawsuits and everything. You know, it's just... But anyway, he said, so during those first hours on the moon, before the planned eating and rest periods, I reached into my personal preference kit and pulled out the communion elements along with a 3x5 card on which I had written the words of Jesus. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever remains in me and I in him will bear much fruit, for you can do nothing without me. I poured a thimbleful of wine from a sealed plastic container into a small chalice and waited for the wine to settle down as it swirled in the 1/6 Earth gravity of the moon. My comments to the world were inclusive. I would like to request a few moments of silence and to invite each person listening in, wherever and whomever they may be, to pause for a moment and contemplate the events of the past few hours and to give thanks in his or her own way. I silently read the Bible passage as I partook of the wafer and the wine and offered a private prayer for the task at hand and the opportunity I had been given. So that was Buzz Aldrin, the second person to walk on the moon.
You just brought tears to my eyes with everything.
Great. But, and there's been Catholics, clear, you know, obviously, who have been in the space shuttle program. Gene Kranz is a Catholic, I believe. And the last person on the moon, and he hates that, Eugene Cernan, he was Catholic. Okay. His last words, and I'm saying that he hates that because kind of the reasons we've been stating is, you know, how can we have gone to the moon and not continued?
Yeah, turned our back on it.
Right. So as Cernan prepared to climb up the lunar lander for the last time, he paused and spoke these words. As I take man's last step from the surface, back home for some time to come, but we believe not too long in the future, I'd just like to say what I believe history will record, that America's challenge of today has forged man's destiny of tomorrow. And as we leave the moon at Taurus Littro, we leave as we came, and God willing, as we shall return, with peace and hope for all mankind. Godspeed, the crew of Apollo 17. And then they returned to Earth on December 19th, 1972. So, what, 11 years after JFK said, let's go, we were done.
Yeah. Well, and so that kind of brings back the idea of the bigger purpose. You know, the original purpose was, let's beat the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't get translated into a different, bigger purpose. And they kept mentioning Christopher Columbus. And according to the history book I was reading, America, the Last Great Hope, which is a quote from an Abraham Lincoln speech, and by William J. Bennett, Christopher Columbus, he wanted to go and explore and everything, but his goal, which I had never realized, was he wanted to raise enough money because he wanted to mount a crusade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not anybody approves of a crusade, which these days is a bad word, and there were some that were more noble than others, that's for sure. I'm not disputing that. But he had a bigger goal in mind. And Isabel and Ferdinand, he had gone to them and they had said, I'm sorry, we're trying to get our country back from the Moors. When we're done, we'll talk to you. And one of the reasons that they funded him was they did move the Moors out. And then they were able to say, now they saw themselves as very Christian, very Catholic. And they wanted to do this, yes, for the profit, yes, for all the other stuff, but they had a bigger goal too, which was to do something great for God.
Hmm.
And without that bigger goal, I think what happens is what we see happening with the space program. You get diverted. So the people who have the big goals have to do things like, let's send the rovers, and that's fine. Or the space station, which really excited me. And what's happening with the space station? I mean,
it's just there.
Completely shut down, right?
Well, no. It's there. Yeah, there are people there.
Okay.
But we, as the United States, can't. We have nothing to send there. If we want somebody to go up there, we go over to Russia and go on one of theirs.
Oh, JFK's turning in his grave. Yeah, because for me, I looked at that and said, oh, this is cool. If we're not going to the moon and doing this other exploration, these are the first steps to helping us go live in other places, like all those great science fiction books from when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it seems to be, I guess they do experiments and things, but it seems to be
exactly.
A stasis.
That's pretty much what they're doing is, you know, they're learning what they can. You know, that's the frustrating thing. you know, so much, you know, the more that I learn about history, you know, so many things go to Nixon. But Richard Nixon, he's the one who said, okay, we're going to stop it at 17. It was planned to go on, but then mm-hmm. he was presented a choice. NASA said, okay, we can go from here and use what we've learned and maybe try to start to figure out how to get farther out, you know, to Mars or wherever. Or we have this orbiter that would be nifty, right? So mm-hmm. What he ended up doing was saying, okay, let's go this way because it was cheaper.
yeah.
You know, and so, I mean, the space shuttle was really nice. I mean, it was neat and everything, but it couldn't do anything other than
right.
just go into orbit and put satellites in space or maybe fix one. But you can't use the space shuttle to go to the moon or go anywhere. All it can do is go to orbit.
Right.
So, yeah. So then when they said, okay, you know, we're going to, the last time my parents spend part of the time in Florida. So I've got to go to Kennedy Space Center a few times.
Oh.
And the last time I was there, it was before President Obama took office. Uh-huh. They had this, it looked a lot like the Apollo space capsule. And they were going back to that style. They were ending, you know, the space shuttle program was ending and they were going to go back to this style.
Mm.
But it was much bigger. You know, it wasn't, you know, when you see the Apollo one, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm a big guy. I wouldn't be able to even be in there.
Yeah.
But it's much bigger. It's much bigger. But they were returning to that style of a capsule and, you know, looking at going back to the moon and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we talk about competition and stuff, and it's pretty clear that China's headed to the moon.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that'll spur activity for us or not. I don't know.
Oh, but, I hope so.
But I hope so too. But yeah, it won't be long till China has gone up there.
Well,
we'll see.
Yeah. And you know, there was another theme going through here that I had noticed it before, but thinking about the podcast as I was watching, it was delicately handled usually, but they kept coming back to it, which is that you never know what events are going to transpire to get you home. And Tom Hanks tells the story. They show it in an interview about when he was doing a mission as a pilot and all he's in big trouble. He doesn't know where he is or something like that. And all his cockpit's lights go out and he's like, oh, great. But what that happens is it helps him see the trail of the ship
he's supposed to be on.
He goes, just leading me home. He goes, if those hadn't gone out, that wouldn't have happened. And that, of course, takes you back to thinking about Gary Sinise's disappointment. I can't remember the astronaut's name.
Yeah, Ken Mattingly. But,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank
you. But he, you know, being the only person who hadn't had measles, had been exposed to measles, they were so worried about somebody getting sick out in space. And he has to stay home, but he is the one who was best trained, best prepared to go through and get the procedures that used just enough power to have the idea that allowed them to draw power from somewhere else to get them home.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. And that's right. And it's also interesting that he actually went on a moon mission. He never stepped on the moon because he was a command module pilot.
Right.
So the command module guy, which is remarkable, just stays up there alone going around the moon while the other two guys go down. And, but he was on Apollo 16, so he actually got to go.
Okay.
And none of the three guys that were in Apollo 13 went again.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But what that made me think of was how many times do we look at something that seems like the biggest disappointment? We're so upset. And then later on, we either discover we had the wrong perspective, it wasn't that big of a deal, or it put us in a place we wouldn't have been in.
Mm-hmm.
I think about my first job. I was in Dodge City, Kansas, and after about a year, I was let go. Well, of course, that was a crushing humiliation for me, but The other thing was I looked back, and that's what set me on the path that sent me looking for a job anywhere. I wound up in Houston. I wound up then coming to Dallas, where the guy who I knew connected to my old work, who showed me around Dallas to get an apartment, is now my husband of many, many years. None of those things would have happened. And I think about Dodge City, I was settling in. I probably never would have moved from that little town. Mm-hmm. I had a comfortable job. I had friends. I had my routine. Why would I go somewhere else? I had to be shoved out.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, a similar story. When I graduated college, I was working for Coca-Cola. I was driving trucks and things for Coca-Cola while I was going to school. Mm-hmm. So I graduate college with an electrical engineering degree, and I'm in Tucson, Arizona. And I decided, well, it would be neat to stay in Arizona. So I started to apply, you know, applied just here and there. I didn't, you know, do any kind of a concerted effort or anything. Mm-hmm. But I kept driving a Coke truck. So here I am working full-time at Coca-Cola with my electrical engineering degree. And, you know, I had friends that are asking, you know, what are you doing? You know, and I enjoyed the job, you know.
Okay.
And, you know, one friend especially, his name is Eric, he would say, you know, dude, come on. What are you doing? So I worked at Coca-Cola with him. He was, you know, he was also going to school. But anyway, after almost a year, I just got to the point where I said, okay, I've got to do something to get out of this, right? So yeah. I actually quit, you know, gave my 2 weeks notice. And I had been applying at other places, including some places in Idaho. So I gave my 2 weeks notice, had no idea what I was going to do after, absolutely no clue. On my last day at Coca-Cola, I walked in there after my day, and you know, you do paperwork at the end of the day, and then someone comes to me and says, hey, you've got a phone call. I was like, oh, that's odd. That, you know, so I walk over and I pick up the phone, and it's Argonne National Laboratory in Idaho saying, hey, we've reviewed your application. We'd like to hire you.
Wow.
Yeah, it was astounding.
Wow. Couldn't no interviewing.
You know, so, no, well, I had gone through an interview and things, you know, I'd been interviewing, you know, various places and stuff. So, anyway, they hired me, and I swear it was the last day, at the very end of the day, I get a call, and it was something else.
Mm-hmm.
So, there was the next thing, and now, you know, I moved from Arizona, so Arizona is not where I was supposed to be.
Well,
and I was trying to stay there, yeah.
Well, yeah, and it's one of those things where it sounds as if you're just sitting there going, okay, put something in front of me, and that's not the way it is. You're trying as hard as you can to do what you're supposed to do or what you think is the best plan, but it kind of goes back to, in that case, that saying that I quote you on for a lot of things is vocation is the lack of obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
And you can try and try and try and try to do something. But guess what? If you're not supposed to, you're just not going to get anywhere. I mean, you can actually force it, but a lot of times there's something else where you're just like, I don't want to do this. And that's actually where you wind up.
Yeah, yeah.
And it turns out to be something that makes you happier than you thought.
Right, right. Yeah, my whole professional life has been like that. I mean, just step after step.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wouldn't be here, you know, here I am in Logan, Utah either. Right now. I mean, all the whole trip, you know, and
yeah,
even the Logan, Utah thing was, difficult, you know, but here I am and things are working out and, you know, yeah, it's just hard to describe. It's just like, okay, mm-hmm. Well, you know, cause you know, I think my own thoughts stop me. You know, it's like, yeah, this is more difficult than what I'm doing right now,
mm-hmm.
You know, and, but yet this thing that I'm doing right now, no longer feels like the right thing to do. And it's hard to listen to that sometimes, but sure, yet since we've come here, things have come to light that I didn't even think about, you know,
really?
Everything from the people I know now at church, you know, from yeah. How well my wife is doing in this town.
Oh,
you know, just all kinds of things that,
and your daughter,
my daughter's doing great.
Yeah.
You know, she's 13. She just turned 13 this week.
Yeah. And who really wanted that move? I mean, in turn, because that's the thing about even something like that, which is an everyday experience, but for the average life without taking a risk and personal possible danger of like, I might hate this. I might move the whole family and we might be miserable. And you can't undertake a great endeavor without those risks. You have to look past them to the greater good.
Yeah.
And that's the whole Gary Sinise thing, really. He was forced out of it, but it's what saved them, helped save them.
Right. And it, you know, saved him too. You know, who knows, you know, if he had been on the ship, you know, who knows what could have happened. But
Kevin Bacon could not have done that.
There's no way. All he was doing was stirring the tanks.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that's tough.
Exactly. And that's tough. What a cast. I forgot that Bill Paxton, you know, Kevin Bacon, Tom Hanks, Kathleen Quinlan, who you don't see much from, but at the time she was somebody who would pop up in a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Ed Harris. I think this was the first movie I ever saw that had him in it.
Yeah, and I like him a lot.
He's
one of my favorites.
It's kept making me think of the Truman
and
Show.
Gary Sinise, too. Gary Sinise, I wish I could see more of him. You know, I think, he's CSI New York. I'm just looking at this on IMDb. I don't think I've seen an episode of CSI.
Yeah.
But,
well, not that one.
But, yeah, he played in The Stand. What was the guy's name? There it is. Stu Redmond.
Really?
Right.
He'd be good for that.
And the first time I ever saw him was of Mice and Men.
Oh.
He played, you know, the main George Milton in of Mice and Men.
Right, the smart one.
Yeah. Opposite, I'm calling that up because I can't recall the guy's name. John Malkovich was Lenny.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, very good movie.
What a pair.
Ray Walston's in it. Sherilyn Fenn plays Curly's wife.
Good heavens.
Yeah. Yeah, good movie.
Well, which I'll never watch unless I'm forced.
Exactly.
I saw the opera, which premiered in Kansas City a long time ago, but it was a straight telling of the story. And I just remember we were all sitting there weeping our eyes out, you know, at the end. And
wow.
Yeah, very sad. But this is also the first movie, where I saw Gary Sinise. And it's funny because later, for a while, and maybe he still can, I'll have to look. There's some Monsignor who does interviews with different Catholic personalities, and it's for the Catholic bishops, or it's under their auspices, I think, and it goes out on Catholic radio, which I don't listen to, because if something's on a podcast, I can't sit around and listen to the radio. I'm just on the go, man. I have an active lifestyle.
So are you saying Gary Sinise is a Catholic?
But Gary Sinise is a converted Catholic.
I didn't know that.
Who, He really impressed me because he was talking about a charity that he and his wife run now for the kids in Iraq because he went there on a USO thing. And then he saw these kids sitting in a corner in the dirt and they were drawing with sticks or something or their fingers. And he went over and it was their school.
Oh, wow.
And he was just, his heart was wrenched because he has children. So he really related. And so he started something just collecting paper and pencils and chalk and a chalkboard. And that became his charity. And he said he, at least at the time I heard the interview, he would go back there a lot more than most other people because he was so interested in this whole situation.
Oh, that's cool. You know, he played Lieutenant Dan Taylor in Forrest Gump. Remember he lost
that.
His legs and things.
With Tom Hanks.
Yeah, with Tom Hanks. And I know that he was active in, you know, wounded military people.
Oh, okay.
He was involved with charities for that, too, as, you know, I think it was called Lieutenant Dan's or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Some charity as well.
He seems intense.
Yeah, yeah.
But I really like him.
Yeah, I do, too.
But yeah. I'm not going to watch Mile,
CSI he was in the Green Mile.
Oh, no, I never saw that.
Oh, good movie. Yeah.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah. Yep.
Just never saw it.
Yeah, very good. So, yeah, so a lot of excellent cast. Excellent cast in this movie.
And
the special effects were good, too. You know, one of the things that they did in this, have you ever heard of the Vomit Comet? Do you know this story?
Yeah. And I thought, how long is that? That's the one where you have, they take you up in it and you act while you're weightless.
Yeah. It's right? used for training astronauts for weightlessness.
And I thought,
yeah.
how much of their time did they have to spend doing 30 second takes?
Yep. Yep. I just thought that was cool that they would do that.
Yeah.
That's neat. You know, yeah. So whose idea was that? Hey, let's do this in 30-second pieces. So yeah, so this airplane, you know, it does this parabola thing in the air, and it's what NASA uses to train people in zero gravity. So they put the actors in there and did some of the scenes in actual zero gravity, rather than trying to do it with special effects. They fly this thing up in the air, and when you do this, you get about 30 seconds of weightlessness, and they did it over and over.
Yeah, think of how much of the time they were shown weightless.
Yeah, yeah.
That whole broadcast that they did that no one saw.
Right, right.
All that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I kept thinking of that, going, oh, man.
Yeah, and it is amazing, you know, Americans.
Oh, Americans.
Oh, Americans, I don't know.
I love you guys at the same time as you annoy me. Oh, wait.
I hardly ever watch TV on TV anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I've been watching Under the Dome, Stephen King's Under the Dome. It's on episode 3.
Okay.
And it's like, you know, anyway, but the tough thing is that you see commercials now, which is a really funny story. I have a funny story because for years we didn't even have DirecTV or Dish or anything like that. We just decided not to.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the TV that we would watch would come in from Netflix for, I mean, it's been like 4 or 5 years now, ever since, you know, they started doing that. That's how we've been getting TV. We turned everything off and just do it that way. So we watch a show called Warehouse 13, Alex and I.
Right.
And we were watching, when we moved to the apartment complex that I'm in right now, DirecTV comes with it. So you don't have a choice not to have it. So we just have it. And we're watching Apollo 13 on regular TV. And Alex looks at me about halfway through. She says, you know, Dad, this is going to take almost a whole hour to watch this show.
Funny how that is.
I couldn't believe it. That was so
quick
funny.
With the math. That one.
Oh, so anyway, so we're watching Under the Dome now. And, you know, so I'm seeing all these commercials about like Survivor and, you know, right. This is on other channels too. I forget which channel Under the Dome is on, but Bachelorette and all this other stuff. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's really?
A wasteland.
Oh, wow. It's really just shocking.
Well, though, it's no worse than watching Hulu and they've mm-hmm. got their commercials every so often.
That's true, you know. And
but I guess I'm inured to it.
Yeah, yeah.
But see, for years, so long that I guess it's since Tom and I got married, we taped everything.
Mm-hmm.
So we just skip the commercials, and you just stop for one that you enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And see, believe it or not, they sometimes have series of commercials that you might want to watch, or if there are trailers for movies, sometimes we'll stop.
So maybe if they make a Mars shot a reality show, that it could get done. That's exactly.
Oh my gosh. Oh, what was that? Big Brother?
Yeah.
On Mars.
Exactly. Big Brother is the one that, so it must be
together.
CBS or something. Yeah, because Big Brother is always those commercials that I'm seeing. It's like, you know, everybody really loves that, but they, you know, we'll watch the Apollo 13 mission, you know, and it's just like, oh my gosh, they're going to the moon.
You don't watch Doctor Who, right?
No, I haven't.
We're just now working our way through the rebooted version. And so we're on season 3. And I have to say, wow, the end of season 3, holy mackerel. They just took off. It's just an adrenaline ride. Can hardly make it through each show, but they're so good. But the one of the early ones, they wind up in some place where there's kind of a very lethal version of Big Brother, you know. And Doctor Who winds up in the middle of the house.
Oh, wow.
he's able to get out and live through what happens afterward. It's the whole thing is game shows, but they're all quite lethal.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. So that's like, that'd be Mars, Big Brother. Big Brother on Mars.
Big Brother Mars.
You make a mistake, duck outside, just, you know, in the garden or whatever.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So.
Try and decide who gets to go.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing, though, that the last thing that I actually noticed about this movie was when they were talking about the astronauts are landing. No one knows if the heat shield's going to be okay. And so Walter Cronkite or whoever is doing the, this is happening. The Jewish people are praying at the Wailing Wall for them. And and the House and Senate passed a resolution asking the U.S. people to pray for a good reentry. And I thought, wow, they passed a resolution. Is that just a standard thing? And now that you're telling me about the atheists complaining about a prayer or reading Genesis in space, I guess not. And thinking, would they even do that these days? Do they even have that much, those many guts?
No, I don't think so.
You know, it's like, what's happened to us? Political correctness made us both thin-skinned, so we take offense at everything, and afraid to do a single thing to stand up for ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting because our priest, the last weekend was the bit of gospel where Jesus tells the 72 disciples to go out into the world together in pairs.
Yeah.
And then they come back and they're just exalted because, oh my gosh, all these things happened. And they're so happy about it. And he points out, he says, usually this is used to talk about vocations. He says, but you know, it occurs to me, he's not sending the apostles. Those are the ones that are, you know, like the priestly vocation. He's sending a bunch of disciples. That's everyone. Mm-hmm. We're the disciples who have to go out and be as innocent as lambs and as wise as doves or whatever. You know, what, I've just massacred that thing and watch out for wolves. And and it makes me think that because then what he segued into is one of the ways that we have to do that is by telling the truth. Says you don't have to say it in an offensive way. We have to be kind and respectful to everyone, but we have to stand up for capital T truth. And there are a lot of truths that are being ignored these days. And our pastor never talks like this. He's very good. And he's always talking about, you know, your inner relationship with God and how that affects everything around you. But this one, he was just saying, look, people, things are getting trampled on. And truth is a lot of it. And freedom is a lot of it. You know, when people are afraid to say, you know, let's all pray for this, because they just get dogpiled on. That's a truth that needs to be out there.
Yeah. Yep.
And it's a right that people should have without getting dumped on.
Yeah. No question.
So he wasn't saying go out and be strident, but he was like, don't back down either.
Yeah. And there's a whole lot of untruth, too. I mean, that's exactly what you're saying, too. But,
yeah,
you know, things that people just take as common knowledge and truth is not, you know, it's frustrating when you run up against that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, it makes me think of some, oh gosh, I should know her name, Wendy Davis, this female legislator in the Texas Capitol that recently did a filibuster for a pro-abortion.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And everybody was so annoyed with her. And I thought, you know, here's the thing. I wish I could get that passion out of the people who believe the way I do, which is not her way. But I had to admire her for taking a personal stand, standing up there and saying what she thought and not backing down. Now, I don't agree with what she was pushing, but what it did was it energized everyone. Evidently, yesterday, hundreds of people showed up on both sides to discuss it. Well, okay, let's have a debate.
Yeah, yeah.
It can be civil, but let's talk it through. Now, I don't have any feeling that's going to happen in a government building, but you can never tell. If somebody doesn't act as a catalyst, how's that going to happen?
Yeah.
And she did it by sticking to the truth as she sees it. Well, that's what we should all do, because that's the only way you can have a civil conversation, or you can start to have one, that examines why everybody thinks the way they do.
Yeah, for sure.
So.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just went on a rant.
That's okay.
Rant done.
Rant finished. Cool. All right. Well, thanks for talking about this one. I really love this movie.
Oh, terrific, great terrific choice. Terrific. Such a perfect choice.
Yes, and I love the optimism of it. You know, last podcast, we were talking a little bit about optimism, and this is, you know, you have every reason to be pessimistic if you were involved with that thing, and how it turned out. I mean, it just shows possibilities.
Yeah.
Can't give up.
Right. Just work the what's the next thing? Let's work the problem.
Work the problem, people.
I loved that. Let's work the problem, people. Don't tell me what you think. Tell me what you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I loved that. And yeah, they never did give up. They might be worried or upset or everything else. But you can see that moment when Jim Lovell turns away from his dream and says, okay, our job is to get home.
Right. Right.
That's where we're going. And he does that thing with his thumb and the earth, you know?
Yeah.
The way he did with the thumb and the moon.
Just like, holy nice cow, bookend. Every single thing that we know as people is under my thumb right now.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. You know, that's something that Carl Sagan really, really understood, is the power of those kind of photographs on people and how it can promote exploration. You know, so he was a guy, there's a famous photograph of the Earth and Moon from far away that he asked, I can't remember if it was a ship that was headed to Mars or I can't remember, but he got NASA to turn it around and snap a photo of the Earth and the Moon together.
Only he would have that power.
Yep, and he'd say,
I think that's great.
He says, we need that picture because it's going to inspire people. And he was definitely right. When you look at that photo, it's just like, my goodness, you know,
you have to put that photo up.
Yeah. Oh, I sure will. And it's, you know, it can give you one of two reactions. You know, the Earth is an insignificant speck in this giant universe, we are unique. Each one of us is unique in this vast universe. And that's an inspiring thought.
Well, and I have to say that the feeling I got when I saw one of those shots of Earth in this movie, when they're from the moon and they're looking back at it, is I was struck with such awe of not, you know, any kind of insignificance, but it's our cradle, it's our womb, it's our life support, it's our ship, spaceship that was designed for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, using evolution. Yes, using science. Yes, using the Big Bang. Using all those things, but it was designed for us, and we were designed for it. I think about that when I'll sit in my backyard and look at the clouds going by and go, wow, new art every day. Thank you. You know?
Oh, right.
You want expression
what it makes,
to start?
What it makes me think about is, you know, when you see the whole Earth at once, is like all of these problems, all of this stuff that we all think about every day, takes on a lot less significance. You know, all of these things that are always dragging us down and you know, the conflicts seem silly when you look at things from that perspective. And, you know, in your personal life, that's great. You know, if you wish you could get all the leaders of all the countries in the world to feel that same thing all the time. I mean, that would be nice.
Yeah. I know. Big thoughts.
You bet.
Well, thank you. This is a great movie, and I hadn't watched it in way too long. We own it, but it's just been a while, so it was great to pull it out and reappreciate it.
Yeah. So well done, Hanks and Howard.
Yes.
Howard and Hanks.
Yes, you and bet. The whole team.
And the whole team, exactly. Everybody. All right, so let's see. In a couple of weeks, we've got Kieran Yaga by Mike Resnick.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting discussion. I think there's going to be a lot of some positive and some negative to talk about on that one. Yeah, but it's definitely going to be worth talking about.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I like his style.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a very accessible style, seems to me. So.
You bet. And then after that, as a movie that you've talked about, it Ushpizin?
I think it's Ushpizin. Ushpizin. It's an Israeli movie.
Right.
Yes.
And then The Hiding Place by Corrie ten Boom.
Yes.
And that brings us out a few weeks.
I know. Wow. Yeah. We'll be in the fall then. But we will. We don't need to anticipate that too much. Let's live in the moment.
Living in now. Yep.
Work the problems now. I think we'd have to say, not, you know, enjoy where we are now.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So those are just things to look forward to. And then to work on Kirin Yaga, which I have on audio. Not sure if I'll have a chance to listen to it before then.
Okay. But sounds good.
I will try.
All right. Well,
you have to actually read it.
All right. Well, thanks again. And thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, thank you.
And we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yeah, have a great couple weeks, everyone.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you.